agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney Jay Carson.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, Jay, how are you doing today?
Well, I'll tell you, it's one of those days where it's difficult to ascertain if I'm apparently successful or not. It's just, you just don't know some days.
Some days. Yeah, absolutely. Before we get to everything that we're going to be talking about today, and there's quite a lot we have to talk about, I want to mention that on my other newish podcast, Politics Makes Me Sick, I got into a lot this week, coastal elites, rigged politics, my argument for Donald Trump's honesty of all things, the Declaration of Independence, economic inequality, capital punishment, abortion, education, progressive taxation, and then I fit in my plan to run for the United States Senate and start a new American political party. And Jay, that was just,
that was all just last week?
12 minutes and 7 seconds. It was a whirlwind tour through all kinds of stuff. And, I've already gotten a lot of questions, including from you, about this insanely ambitious thing. Why don't I just run for city council or something like that? And I should say, in my city of Cincinnati, there are plenty of openings now. With one third of the city council this year has been indicted on federal corruption charges. So, but the reason is that I'm trying to draw as much attention possible to what I see as really the enormous flaws in both of our main political parties, and to try to create an alternative. And that's not the sort of message you can run on as, a city council candidate or a county commissioner or something like that. And I guess more than anything else, my goal is to try to do more than just talk about the sad state of American politics, which you and I have been doing for years now.
You want to participate in the
to really try to do something more. And, podcasts and books, I think, on political reforms and all that are great, but they're sort of inherently limited. And I just want to at least take a crack at moving past these limits. And so, I hope that people who agree with me that American politics is in a bad place will at least listen to some of my ideas and let me know, good, bad, or indifferent, what you think. And, you can find the show. It's politicsmakesmesick.com, or just, search for it on your podcast app. And I would really appreciate any feedback that you have. So there you go.
Well, I salute your civic engagement and wish you the best of luck in this. And we'll be talking about it and hearing a lot about it as we go forward.
Absolutely. So, okay. Well, with that, Jay, why don't we get to the matter at hand? And of course, go ahead.
So our first story today is the sort of the same story that we've been looking at for 2 weeks as to who won this election and when will it officially be called. Trump's ability to contest some of these votes in court in different states, his options are narrowing. I'm not going to go through the entire list, but it's not looking good. There was one editorial writer put it sort of pithily, the fat lady maybe hasn't sung yet, but she's clearing her throat. In the midst of this, Rudy Giuliani held a news conference on Thursday that might best be described as just plain nuts, alleging a vast conspiracy to steal the election by Democrats. And it's, again, we'll talk in a second, the strangeness of this. And then the other strange piece, Trump called some Michigan lawmakers to meet with him at the White House, ostensibly to try to make the argument that, look, Michigan was stolen. Therefore, the state legislature ought to just assign electors to me. As of this morning, the response from those Michigan lawmakers was, no, we don't think anything in Michigan's going to change. With that, Mike, what do you think happens next? in terms of how this gets officially sealed in the books. And the other piece I forgot to mention, of course, is we're coming up on these certification deadlines. Georgia has already certified its vote count. The Trump administration has sought to block certification in Michigan. It's doubtful that that will happen. What's up next, Mike?
Well, what's up next is what everyone expects to be up next, is that the states will all certify, and then the Electoral College will send our results in. The Electoral College will meet, and Joe Biden will win will be certified as the winner of the election with 306 electoral votes. And that's what everyone who's not buying into insane conspiracy theories knows. And you know, Jay, I never thought, it's weird for me to say this, these words coming out of my mouth, but I agree with Tucker Carlson. This is not a sentence I would.
I was going to point out Tucker Carlson later on. Yes.
Tucker Carlson,
go ahead.
Yeah, this week argued that if the claims of Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and the Trump team are correct, this would constitute the greatest crime in American history. Right. The stealing of a presidential election. And I certainly agree with that. And then he went on to say, of course, given this extraordinary claim, actual evidence needs to be put up. And the Trump team has failed to do that in any forum. Right. And so but what that means then, it seems to me, is that if you argue that attempting to steal an election is the greatest crime in American history, then you have to look at what the Trump team is doing. And therefore, it seems to me you can turn that argument around and say, well, what they are doing is attempting the greatest crime in American history. And maybe it's it's clearly a sad and pathetic attempt, but that makes it no less a great crime. In fact, I think you can argue, and I think it's a strong argument, that this is the worst thing that Donald Trump has done in his entire life. And that's no small statement.
That's a lot of stuff. First of all, I would also add, I think that the Tucker Carlson piece, he went on to say, listen, we'd invite, you know, Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani onto the show. We'll give him the entire hour. We'll give him an entire week.
Yeah.
You know, tell us what you've got. And then Tucker Carlson the show kept trying to contact these folks and got an angry call back from Sidney Powell's people saying, quit bugging us.
Yeah.
if you've lost Tucker Carlson, you know, I think the fat lady is singing at this point. So now whether what Trump is doing is the worst crime ever, it's one of the worst things he's ever done, because I think it, two things. Let me back up, because I think I want to draw some lines here, because I think it's completely legitimate to challenge things in court where you have some evidence to indicate that there was some irregularities, there were some shenanigans, there was some malarkey.
Absolutely.
And I think there's some of those cases. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago. And Ken and I actually agreed that, yes, there's, you know, for example, observers weren't allowed to be where they were supposed to be, and there's a factual dispute over that and all that. But look, that's a legit claim. Now, does it invalidate an election? No. Does it change any votes? No, because you need that the extra piece of, well, we couldn't observe, and we also think that XYZ happened. There are things like in the Georgia recount, you know, they found sort of a whole other precinct that contained essentially a net Trump votes of about 1,500 that had not been recorded. And it's apparently just a matter of human error. But it was something about, I want to say it was like 2,500 votes, and I could have the numbers wrong, but the Trump increase would have been 1,500. And look, that's not nothing. And again, whether it's fraud or whether it's human error, it's important to look at these things to get it right in order to have confidence in the system. So I think it's worth noting that in a lot of these cases, the court cases, the pleadings have been much more circumspect than the stuff that Giuliani's putting out. They have focused on, well, we think there's some errors here. We think there, you know, procedures were not properly followed here. Absentee ballots were perhaps not segregated as they're supposed to be. All that I think is is good, and I think it's actually good for democracy to challenge that, right? Because you want to have a clean election, and challenging these things makes them less likely to happen the next time. Put systems in place to fix it. All that said, Ken and I also agree that, look, there's nothing that you can tell from these cases, the actual court cases, which again are kind of falling like dominoes, that even if successful, the numbers are there to change the outcome. So I think sometimes that troubles me a little bit to when things get painted with too broad a brush, right? And that's why Giuliani is so singularly unhelpful, is that he sort of derails all the, you know, what might be legitimate issues. And then anytime it's boy who cried wolf, right? Or it's Joe McCarthy. You know, you sort of lose the, you know, then anytime you say, well, wait a minute, I think we need to take a look at it. That's, oh, it's just the Giuliani conspiracy theory. But, you know, again, all that said, the Giuliani press conference was just plain, you know, bonkers.
Well, you know, I would say bonkers, certainly, and not just for, you know, optics and hair dye or whatever related issues. But you know, I think it's easy to, when we think of these terms, you can say bonkers or nuts and so forth. But what it is more than anything else, it's disgraceful. And, you know, we should call it what it is. When you have Trump's campaign attorney, Sidney Powell, saying President Trump won by a landslide, which is a bald-faced lie. And we have repeated people who are representing President Trump saying things that are just outlandish lies. Now, of course, I can't prove that, but the burden of proof, if you say that this is the greatest crime perpetrated in American history, and you offer just some weird theory about Hugo Chavez and, you know, whatever. I mean, that's like me saying that you're a Martian, and I can't prove that you can't prove that you're not, maybe. But, and so this to me is despicable. And I think it's especially, maybe Donald Trump in some weird way actually believes he won. I don't know. But it is impossible for me, Jay, to believe that all these people surrounding the president believe that these are legitimate cases and legitimate theories of what happened. And so what that means then is that they have made a conscious, rational, in their right minds decision to tell these massive lies, to try to attempt to subvert democracy in the most fundamental way for some sort of, I don't know what, personal power motive or something like that. And our reaction to that shouldn't be laughing it off. It should be utter disgust and contempt, shouldn't it?
I think, you know, maybe my system's just calibrated differently. And almost I'll tell you, in my view, saying it's just absolutely bonkers is sort of worse than saying it's malicious and lying and all that, because it's right. I mean, I don't think anyone actually, you know, again, Tucker Carlson.
Let me stop you there, because I want to respond to that point especially. There have been multiple polls now that show that, you know, 70% or more of Trump voters believe that this election was illegitimate and that Donald Trump was the rightful winner. And that's around 51 million Americans or so. If those polls are, and so this isn't just, well, no one believes this stuff. There are tons of people who believe this stuff, and that. So, yeah, on one level, I agree with you. This is just sad and pathetic, almost more than anything else. Rudy Giuliani, it's just, I don't know, maybe he must be deeply concerned with, I don't know, something. He seems like a truly damaged man. But more than that, it's the damage that they're doing to the American electorate, to people who want to believe this stuff and are given a reason to do so because the president and so many people around him are spouting this garbage.
See, to me, and again, maybe this is just a mindset thing. But I think the better response, the more powerful response, is derision rather than outrage, right?
I see what you're saying. Again, sure, I get what you're saying. Yeah,
just the way I look at it, it's not like, you know, I am outraged that the Rudy Giuliani is, I mean, it's almost, because it's, again, it gets to the point of like, it's sort of tough to be outraged when it's so just laughable and goofy, right?
So you'd be outraged if it had a better chance of succeeding.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I get what you're saying.
And I think, so that's what I mean. I think the better criticism I think the better criticism is not you lie. It's you're crazy. I mean, that's but again, I know I get where you're coming from, and I get the outrage angle. I think that most people aren't buying it, and I'm not sure. Again, you've got the poll numbers that say that certainly some are, and
tens of millions, and that's not nothing, right? Well, let me ask you this.
Well, I guess I'd have to look at the poll and how it's conducted and who they ask and what the questions are, because like I said, if you asked me, was there voter fraud in the 2020 election? I'd say absolutely.
Of course there was. Yeah. I mean, sure, there always is.
So if you're taking that now, but if you ask me, did President Trump actually win by a landslide? I would say, no, that's crazy.
See, this is the problem I have with you, Jay. You are a decent, intelligent, and rational person. And I think oftentimes you make the mistake of assuming that all Americans are more or less like you, and they're just not, Jay. They're not. They're a lot more manipulable. They're a lot more, I don't know what the word you want to use. And so I wish more people were like you. It would certainly be a better country in a lot
Indeed.
Of ways, but that's not the case, sadly, and that is my main concern. You know, another thing I wanted to ask you about, this is an aspect of this we haven't really gotten to, is what a lot of people are calling Republican complicity, and not just people like Barack Obama, who said that Republicans are just intimidated by the president. People that I know you respect, like Kevin Williamson, like Jonah Goldberg, conservative columnists who just this week, Kevin Williamson said, what does the Republican Party stand for aside from kooky conspiracy theories? Well, maybe not much at this point. Or, Jonah Goldberg calling the RNC hosting this event that Giuliani did this thing, just a hate crime against Democratic legitimacy, and the GOP social media accounts spewing out all this stuff. So what's your reaction to that? Because these are people who have a little more distance. They're not the president's attorneys who are hired to make a case for him and by any means possible, I guess, throwing ethics out the window. This is the Republican Party establishment.
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of the party establishment, though, saying no, that there's no evidence of this, or they're taking a position saying, look, okay, if then show me the evidence. And you've got folks that the Secretary of State of Georgia is a Republican and did the recount and certified the results and has said this is what it is, and there's no evidence of fraud, and there was missing votes, but it looks like that was the again human error. And I think you've got other Republican office holders, the folks he called down from Michigan, who said, look, no, we're not interested in any of this kind of nonsense. My mind's blanking on some of the other senators. I think Mitt Romney has been, vocal, if not on the election piece, but on the next piece, we'll talk about the transition. Right. I think there have been a number of Republican senators who said, look, this is nonsense. You got to move forward with the transition briefing and planning and letting open up the money for the transition. I think there's been a broad response there. So now, as far as the RNC hosting, I don't know how all that played out. Right. Look, I suppose if I'm the RNC and I get a call from the president's campaign saying, hey, we need somewhere to hold a press conference. Rudy Giuliani is going to say some stuff. Can we do it in front of your building? I think, probably the answer is yeah.
Sure.
I don't know whether they say, well, let me see a script first. One, I think had they asked, they would have said there isn't one.
Yeah, exactly. We're just making it up as we go along. Yeah.
I mean, it may well be. We don't know what the hell he's going to say. So, I mean, I'm willing to kind of give them a little bit of a pass there, for saying, hey, listen, the candidate of your party's, warrior wants to make a speech. Can we use your sidewalk? Now, I think they may think twice next time they get one of those requests.
What do you think about, for instance, we haven't talked about this yet, about the Donald Trump firing Christopher Krebs? Was that was that a legitimate or reasonable move? Or, you know, because I guess certainly Krebs has pushed back very hard on President Trump's lies about the election and the integrity of the election. And so, and he, by all reports, expected to be fired. And I kind of wanted to get your take on that as well, because the, earlier in the week, that certainly, you know, got a lot of people's attention before the Giuliani-Powell press conference craziness.
Yeah, I, you know, look, it's Trump being Trump. I think it's certainly a bad decision. Again, is he within his rights to fire him? I think probably, but you know, I think it undercuts the Trump's credibility even further when it's one of these. I'm going to, you know, if there's a critic, I'm going to get rid of him. So yeah, I don't know that it's,
yeah.
Did, yeah. I mean, again, do I see this as a gross abuse of power? No. Do I see it as petty and stupid? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. We can agree on that for sure. Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, because I think both of us agree that there is an extraordinarily high probability that on January 20th, Joe Biden will be inaugurated as the 46th president. Do you think Donald Trump will be there?
I do.
Wow.
I do.
You do. Okay.
I've said this before, and I'm gonna keep saying it. And look, I may be completely wrong, and everyone can say that. But I think once this all plays out, I think he will make a point of being the most gracious former president whose election was stolen. you know, it's going to be the greatest transition ever. It's going to be a beautiful transition. All of that.
My reading of that is 180 degrees the opposite, because that would, to me, that would be Donald Trump admitting in some way that he was a loser. And I think
I think it would be something like, look, even though this election was absolutely stolen, it was completely fraudulent, and I'm the real president, I'm so gracious that I'm going to hand over power to Joe Biden for the good of America.
I get what you're saying, yeah, and that's something that you would do, maybe. But I can't think of a single instance in my life, in his life, in his public life, of Donald Trump being what anyone would call gracious. And so, to me, that is just entirely out of character for the man. I don't expect him to be there. I would not be surprised if there's some amount of violence just before, at, or shortly after Joe Biden's inauguration. That would not surprise me at all. I hope I'm wrong about that, but
yeah, no, the violence thing would surprise me very much. I would put it this way: if you were to give Trump a choice, say, "Listen, Mr. President, would you like to be on TV or not be on TV?" He will pick be on TV. I'm just about positive, right?
See, I could see him holding a press conference broadcast by, I don't know, One America News Network or something like that at the same time, and then talking and lying about the audience of 200,000 that he had, or 20 million or 800 billion. Yeah, exactly. But let me, a more substantive question. What do you see as the effect of this on American politics going forward? Because to me, it seems like, okay, the positive case maybe is Donald Trump's an outlier, but I see him as remaining a Republican kingmaker, and I expect that either he'll run in 2024, assuming that he's healthy enough, or, you know, and I don't think he's going to prison or anything like that. Most of the things he's being charged with are civil things, but I think that whomever emerges from the Republican primaries is more than likely to be in his mold, because that's the sort of thing that I think primaries reward, you know. So I see like a Ron DeSantis, a Ted Cruz, a Tom Cotton, maybe even a Tucker Carlson. Those are the people I think are going to be more likely to really engage with the people who got Donald Trump the nomination and darn near got him a second term as president. So I don't see, you know, someone like a Nikki Haley, a Marco Rubio, or I don't know, a Ben Sasse being able to do that. I think that at least in the near term future, we might not get Donald Trump, but we're going to get Trump Lite or Trump 2.0.
Yeah, but I think there's a pretty big gap between even say a Ted Cruz and a Donald Trump. Right. I mean, Cruz, and you can say what you will for him, but he's got a here is my consistent ideological platform. You may disagree with it, but again, like the line from the Big Lebowski, you know, you say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, at least it's an ethos.
Dangerous if he takes the populist authoritarian lessons from Donald Trump and is able to integrate those with much more discipline, well, then that could be potentially even worse, because Donald Trump has regularly been his own worst enemy. I mean, I tend to think that if Donald Trump had been even 10% less Trump, despite everything that's gone on, he would probably be getting ready to serve his second term.
Oh, no, I agree. But the people you're talking about are still traditional politicians, right? They're folks who went through that sort of training and ran for office. And Cruz, for example, was a Supreme Court clerk. As was Hawley. They come through that. You know, as much as they like to portray themselves as outsiders, they're not as outside as Donald Trump was.
I think maybe the difference here is it's possible that you have a better opinion of national office seekers or national politicians who've been successful than I do. I used to think that they were fundamentally good people, but I don't believe that anymore. I believe that most of them are deeply damaged in significant ways, and they have a problematic, to say the least, lust for power. And if they see a path to power, they will pursue that path to power and use whatever self-serving justifications help them sleep at night and make them feel good about themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's why I was saying that Ted Cruz would say, hey, look, this worked for Donald.
I didn't think the question was, are these good people? I mean, I think the question was, what did I think they would react, or would they follow the Trump mold? As a conservative, I think you just sort of laid out one of the basic tenets of conservatism, right?
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. And that people who are in the national spotlight and seeking higher office, they're there because they're hungry for power. And, some are better than others, and some that hunger is tempered by something else, be it religion, be it civic, a feeling of civic duty, whatever. But I would tend to agree that, politics ain't beanbag.
So, you mentioned the transition, which I think is another kind of closely related thing, obviously, we wanted to get into.
And I'm supposed to be, moving from topic to topic, but I'm not good at that, and I get stuck.
We figure it out. It's fine.
Yeah, whatever. The other big news we're discussing the related is the refusal, or the I don't know if it's refusal, a just sort of decline to act of the General Services Administration in releasing funds and officially starting the presidential transition. There was a statute passed in 1963. The Presidential Transition Act, which allocates money for transition teams and sets up sort of just the basics of moving people in and out, the HR process of getting people vetted and security cleared and so forth. Related to that is obviously the intelligence briefings for the incoming president and vice president. And at this point, the director of the GSA has declined to release those funds. The act says that you need to release them once the director determines that the has ascertained the most. Oh my gosh, I had this in front of me now.
I'll read it here. The terms president-elect and vice-president-elect as used in this act shall mean such persons as are the apparent successful candidates for the office of the president and vice president, respectively, as ascertained by the administrator.
Apparently successful. That's what I was looking for. Given that, I take it you're going to believe that, or say the GSA has acted inappropriately by not declaring Joe Biden apparently successful.
Well, I would hate to be Emily Murphy.
I will start by saying he appears successful to me.
I would, like I said, I would hate to be Emily Murphy. It seems to me that this, we've talked about this before, this idea between law and custom or tradition. And oftentimes when you try to write a law that takes into account every possible contingency, it's a bad, awful, incredibly wordy sort of law that ends up creating more problems than it solves. And so I think when the Presidential Transition Act was written and was signed into law, there was sort of an implicit assumption that once the winner was apparent, the loser would concede, as losers have essentially almost always done within a week or within a day or so. I mean, you look at 1960, a great example, right? Super close election and a lot more credible evidence of fraud than certainly in this election. But,
right.
You know, Richard Nixon conceded the next day to John Kennedy. And when he could have, I think, made a pretty good case for fighting on there. And that's, you know, that's generally been the, you have to go back to 1916 for a delay in a concession this long. Charles Evans Hughes took 2 weeks to actually finally say, you know, Woodrow Wilson, yeah, you won, I concede. And so I think you have to understand that background. I don't think it was ever considered that a president would have clearly lost or a candidate would have clearly lost. And he would just say, you know what, I'm just not going to concede.
Yeah. No, I agree with you 100% on that. I think this is a matter of no one would have seen this coming. I look at this as I think it's probably the better practice for not having essentially the GSA declare a presidential winner, right? That troubles me a little bit.
Well, again,
the precedent it could set.
Yeah, it's not troublesome as long as the loser concedes, which the loser always does. And so there have been
in the way it's worked. I mean, the closest time that this happened before, obviously, was Bush and Gore. And what happened was the GSA administrator said, look, I can't tell at this point. And then after the Supreme Court ruled, Gore conceded, you know, it was like that day or the next day, GSA said, yes, here, you know, okay.
Because, there was real doubt. It was, you know, like 537 votes and a very close sort of in this, they saw it's not this. So, you know, it seems to me that in this situation where even though it's clear to everyone, except for a small group of, you know, like those Japanese after World War II on the island, there fighting away that the only legal clarification that would make sense would be something like concession of the candidate or certification of state votes totaling 270 or more electoral
votes. Yeah. The electors meet next month. I mean, I think at that point, there's a bright line that you can say, listen, the Electoral College has met and they've selected a president. So apparently that's, I think.
But of course,
do you see my point?
But because the problem here, let's say you have a statute like that, but then let's say the Libertarian Party candidate decides I'm not going to concede and launches legal challenges. Well, then maybe by the statute, then the election is still in doubt and you can't. This is the problem that you run into when you rely on kind of, what is it called, black letter law on all of this stuff, as opposed to assuming, at least to a certain extent, that people will behave like decent human beings.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, though, it's not necessarily that the election's in doubt. It's whether certain funds can be released. And there's a procedure, and it's followed, you know, fairly commonly, too, where, you know, the incoming president can use campaign funds for a transition pending, a GSA open up its purse.
Yeah, no, but the bigger
thing is like everybody's talking about the GSA. This is probably like the unsexiest government agency, you know, ever. It's like literally, if the question is how many government employees does it take to change a light bulb at the post office, that's the GSA is like the people who would handle that. And it's one of those. So if people don't follow this stuff, GSA is sort of the general General Services Administration, and what they do are general services like taking care of federal properties. And, you know, if the thermostat's on the fritz at the Social Security office, you call the GSA. And again, they do general sort of the HR stuff. And then sort of also they're sort of now being injected into this naming a president. So that's.
Well, and the bigger problem is that the Biden team is not getting access to information more than anything else. And given the fact that we're in the midst of a surging pandemic, which we'll get to in a minute here, I mean, that is this decision. And I would put this more on the president's team rather than, you know, poor Emily Murphy, you know, who seems to be a technocrat who's just in a horrible, horrible place. This is a decision that, you know, and Joe Biden said this is costing lives, and maybe that seems like a dramatic way to put it, but it's also, I think, not an unreasonable way to put it. And there would be a way for, I think, President Trump to make relevant legal challenges and still allow for, you know, this sort of transition thing to go forward. But of course,
absolutely. Yeah, no. And I think that's, you know, Republicans were, you know, criticized heavily the Clinton team in 2000, and I think fairly so. Look, I'll criticize the Obama team in 2016 in terms of you know, not wanting to brief Trump because they thought he was a Russian spy and sending the FBI to you know, try to get dirt on his national security advisor. So I agree with most of the Republican senators who have said, "Nah, look, it's, you know, they ought to be getting the briefings, they ought to be getting the information." Joe Biden is clearly someone who I think has high level security clearance that, you know, we don't have to worry about that sort of thing. Kamala Harris is already a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, so presumably she's getting that information anyway. So I think that's absolutely silly, and this is one of those things that I think undercuts Trump in that he could say, look, I don't see any downside for Trump to go forward with these briefings, except that he may see it as some sort of concession of defeat.
Do you think it's problematic that Donald Trump seems to have ceased operating as president of the United States for the most part during this period and doesn't seem to be inclined to do so?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of, I mean, right. I mean, you sort of might welcome that, right? He's sort of checked out, and the things that, you know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, the things that he wasn't in charge of that kind of ran by themselves were the things that went really well. So maybe that's okay, right? On the other hand, maybe it also just feels like Trump has checked out because we're used to having Trump talking to us, you know, 10 times a day, and you know what I mean? So any sort of
just looking at his public schedule and, you know, who he's meeting and his lack of engaging with seemingly anyone except for on this particular issue. I mean, he said, you know, I agreed with President Trump when he said, you know, I'm president of the United States to the last day of my term. And I said, well, yeah, you have a duty then to do your job, even if you are fighting for, you know, another 4 years in office, you still have a job to do. And it seems to me that he's abdicated that responsibility, which doesn't surprise me at all, but is just another example. I think if anyone needed more example of Donald Trump's complete and utter unfitness for the office of president of the United States, I can't imagine they would at this point, but there you go.
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I mean, the federal government is still seems to be working. I'm not sure that, you know, you don't have a lot of presidents in lame duck who do a lot of, and I'm trying to think back to the last one would have been George H.W. Bush. Mm-hmm. What did he do in the interim between the election and and Clinton's inauguration? And I mean, nothing jumps to mind.
But he also wasn't dealing with, you know, the greatest national crisis since World War II.
Yeah.
And I think that makes a difference.
But look, I think, you know, we've talked about this a lot, and actually we can segue to that. Our next story.
Sure.
Is the continued coronavirus crisis. You know, cases have surged. We are now at over 2 million a day, and the daily average. We've exceeded the 250,000 dead, and states are taking various actions in terms of shutdowns or curtailing economic activity or putting in new restrictions. And you know, yeah, we're in the midst of that. At the same time, we have one vaccine candidate that was submitted to FDA approval on Friday, another on the way, and there is a potential that vaccines could start being distributed as early as next month. So you know, I think it's bad news, but there's also glimmers of hope there. And I'm not entirely sure what else the president, you know, ought to do. I mean, you could do the hortatory sort of stuff about, you know, get out, wear a mask, and, you know, encourage people to be socially distant and do that kind of bully pulpit stuff.
And he does the opposite of that.
He does the opposite. And you and I have disagreed on how much. And again, maybe it's just because I don't listen to Trump. So I, like you said, I just assume that other people don't, you know, or I shouldn't say I don't listen to him, but I don't.
You don't take him as an authority who kind of directs how you live your life.
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah. Which again, that comes back to a very, very core conservative principle, that, yeah, I live my life and I don't care what the government says, Mike, whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden, you know, you make up your own mind. So, but that said, where do you think we're going on coronavirus next steps, and what should the federal government be doing if it's that it's not doing now?
Well, I think there are a number of things that they need to be doing, and there are some pretty important protections that are going to end at the end of this year. Now, I hope Congress will get its act together, and you know that there could be as many as 12 million additional Americans losing unemployment insurance by the end of the year, and that needs to be, I think, extended. So I think at a minimum, you know, we should extend, for instance, that pandemic unemployment assistance program until at least April, I would say, because that's just about the biggest bang for your buck you're likely to get in terms of stimulus, and also, you know, the right thing to do for millions and millions of Americans who are hurting the most from this. I also think Congress needs to extend the eviction moratorium for at least the same length of time, though, honestly, what I think we really need is more low-income renter assistance, because if you extend the moratorium and don't have any funds there,
you're hurting low-income landlords.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then I think we need to renew the Paycheck Protection Program to keep small businesses going as this gets worse. You know, that ended back in August, and things were looking a lot better then than they certainly do now. And there's actually a bill that was introduced, believe it or not, by, I'll say this, I agree with Marco Rubio and Susan Collins. At the end of July, they submitted a standalone bill that would give $250 billion more for a second round of Paycheck Protection Program, and it's gone absolutely nowhere. I think we need to see some standalone bills get sent through here, and both parties stop this political gamesmanship of trying to get as much as they can in some sort of massive omnibus thing, because there are millions of Americans who are really hurting, and there are specific things that have bipartisan agreement that absolutely, if they were put up for a vote, would pass. And I find it just reprehensible that those things aren't happening.
No, I would agree with you on most of the items you ticked off there. Although I do want to push back a little bit on the unemployment piece, because you know, obviously in unemployment is handled by the states in most cases. Now, what we've got is there has been sort of federal extension, the federal additional benefits that have been added on. So I think there's, I guess my point is I wouldn't put this all on the feds.
No, but the states are in such a difficult position because, of course, states, you know, don't have the sort of borrowing.
Although the unemployment numbers for Ohio just last month came back at about 5.5%, which is, higher than you'd want them to be. But certainly not the 15% they were a couple months ago.
Right.
So I think there's an argument to be made that as you open up, as we get the vaccine, you want more people seeking work and getting work and being able to go into jobs.
I don't disagree with that.
So I disagree with you on that. But
well, let me, before you move on to your second point, I don't disagree with you on that. But even in the most optimistic scenario, a significant number of Americans aren't going to get that vaccine. We're not going to be able to go back to anything close to normal until probably late spring, early summer. And we know for a fact that things are going to get worse because we have Thanksgiving right around the corner. Then we have Christmas, and we know a whole bunch of Americans are going to get together. So right now, things look worse in terms of cases and hospitalizations than they ever have, and they're just going to get worse still. And so we have to factor that in mind. This isn't going to just because there's a virus or there's a vaccine that's 95% effective. We're talking next summer at earliest before things can open up in the way. So things are going to get a lot worse, and that money needs to get to the people who need it the most, and also where it provides the most stimulus. Because for every dollar you spend on unemployment insurance, you get like something like $1.61 or something like that, based on one study from Moody's, in additional economic activity, and that's what we need to see.
Then why do any of us work?
Well, obviously, it only works to a point, Jay, and you understand that. I mean, you're making a facetious point, but when we talk about economic stimulus, you know, especially when things are being shut down to protect people's lives, when we see this spike, you're not. I'm sure you're not arguing that, you know, we should have everything opening up and that sort of thing.
Well, I think places that can open up safely should stay open, because that's the best route to keeping everybody afloat. I absolutely agree with you on the payroll protection loans. I think that's a good policy, and that was extremely successful, I think you can say. And I do think these things are going to happen now that the election's over. You know, whether they happen in lame duck in December, whether they happen very early January.
My concern, Jay, because when I look at the politics of this, I think Democrats are saying, you know, there's an outside chance. I would say they may be saying maybe not a good chance, but there's not an unreasonable chance that we could somehow manage to pick up both of these Georgia seats, and then all of a sudden we can go big. Or at least bigger on some of this stuff, because you still have to get some, you know, you have to get a few more conservative Democratic senators. But I think that those calculations that both sides are making are going to make it very difficult for anything to get through. And that's just a really depressing thing to me about this.
You could do both, though, I think, right? I mean, I think you could pass something in lame duck, and then if the Democrats are successful in taking the Senate, can say, well, what we did back then was wholly ineffective. We need another $3 trillion or $2 trillion or whatever it's going to be. So, yeah, I get the idea that sometimes
you're right.
Get a shot to do this once, but in this case, we've actually already done this sort of like two or three times.
I hope you're right. I mean, also, we have a budget to pass, by the way. You know, I think we have the CR ends in sometime in mid-December, so maybe some targeted things get rolled into that in some way. I don't know, but I certainly hope that we get more than nothing.
Yeah, I think there is enough on both sides that something will get done. Now, I thought something would get done before the election, and I was incorrect.
No, you were right. A Supreme Court justice got confirmed, so there was the important thing.
Well, I was right on that.
Yeah.
So I guess the next piece, and this ties into a little bit because it relates to the Fed, Judy Shelton was a Federal Reserve nominee who did not procure enough votes in the Senate to be appointed. So this is something of a surprise, I think. But, you know, she had some pushback from Republicans who were concerned that she was perhaps a little too unorthodox compared to the current Fed. So what are your thoughts on the Shelton nomination and why she got knocked out? Now, I should say it doesn't mean it's necessarily over. They could try again. And maybe you round up some more people and, you know, just sort of, you know, make sure that you have all your ducks in a row first.
Big problem is, you know, Republican senators keep on getting COVID for some reason.
I don't know.
You know, it's like a political disease that targets Republicans. I don't know. It must be Venezuela that's doing it or something like that. Hugo Chavez invented it in a lab with the Chinese to destroy Republicans or something. Anyway, no, I mean, I think if those two Republican senators hadn't been out with COVID, her nomination would have passed. And I think that's disturbing. You know, a lot of the focus has been on the fact that she is something of a gold bug, as they say, but I think that's been overblown. Certainly she's out of the mainstream on that, but she sort of walked back some of those views. She's not calling for a return to the gold standard or anything like that, though. She's kind of made an argument about some of the, I guess you could say, some of the issues potentially with fiat currency. I think the economic mainstream clearly rejects those views. But to me, what the more concerning thing is her views on the independence of the Federal Reserve. And that to me, you know, when she says, well, the Fed should pursue a more coordinated relationship with both Congress and the president, depending on how you take that in and of itself, say, well, okay, that seems reasonable, right?
But everybody ought to get along and play nice together.
Yeah, but then you kind of take a look at sort of her public statements and actions as a whole, and you know, Obama's president and she hates low interest rates, and all of a sudden Trump's president and she becomes a zero interest rate warrior. And so Donald Trump has a history of appointing people to, or trying to appoint people to the Fed who either A, are completely unqualified, like Herman Cain, for instance, or people who seem to be willing to go along with what the president wants, maybe a little more than is traditional for the Fed. And so that's what concerns me. And I think that's what should concern both Democrats and Republicans, not so much that gold view, but her shaky views on the independence of the Fed. Because if I were a senator, I would have a hard time voting to confirm anyone who even hinted that the Fed should somehow be beholden in any way to what the president or Congress wants.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on Fed independence. So there's two questions there. One is the Fed independence. The other is what actually would be her view on monetary policy. And historically, you would say she is not a sort of new monetarist,
yeah.
You know, let's slash interest rates to zero or below,
modern monetary policy
is what I'm trying to get out. It's been a rough week. You know, but so I think it's almost that is, an idea that people from both parties, I think, dislike, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Again, theoretically, right? More conservatives ought to be more in favor of tight money or at least a more activist monetarist policy, right? Sort of an Alan Greenspan type, Paul Volcker type view. Whereas Democrats, I think it's always, you know, let's put more you know, it's pouring sugar into the economy, right?
And Shelton was like that until she wasn't. And to me, well, the main thing I would look for in a Fed governor is someone who's very sort of stable and consistent. I don't know. To me, that's a pretty important qualification. And then you add that with her saying in October of this year I don't see any reference to independence in the legislation that has defined the role of the Federal Reserve. Well, okay, maybe
it's kind of baked in, right?
Yeah, so
the way that they're appointed, yeah.
So that I think what's most disturbing to me is the fact that had it not been for a couple COVID absences, she would have been confirmed, and she could still very well be confirmed.
There was still some pushback among other Republicans.
Yeah, but there were the votes.
So, and I agree. No, I agree that, look, you know, that, yeah, but for COVID, probably.
And I guess I wonder if Senate Republicans think somehow that what they would be getting with Shelton would be worse than what, say, after January 20th, what President Biden would, the sort of person President Biden would nominate.
Yeah. No, I think there's that. Yeah. I think that plays into whether they try this again. Anyway, with that, I think we're probably just about out of time.
Yeah.
For our regular show. So you can do the closing stuff.
All right. Well,
you have that memorized, and I would stumble through it.
Yeah.
Terribly.
You know, there were a couple of things that we really wanted to get to, but we will get to on the bonus show, like, for instance, the troop drawdowns in Afghanistan and Iraq. And also, we're going to talk about student loan forgiveness, because that's become a big issue on the left now with Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer wanting its $1 trillion forgiveness and Joe Biden sort of pushing. Anyway, we'll get into that and then maybe take some listener questions as well on the Patreon supporter show. And of course, that will be ready for you in your feed by the time you hear this. Well, no, it actually won't be. It'll be ready on Wednesday this week in our Patreon supporter feed. And if you'd like to become a supporter, just go to patreon.com/politicsguys and sign up. And as always, if you can't afford to become a supporter, just email me, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you full access to all the stuff we put out. And that includes ad-free versions of everything, which is kind of a nice thing as well. Also, if you haven't already subscribed to the show, we would really appreciate it if you could. And leaving ratings and reviews, sharing your favorite episodes is also incredibly helpful. So we'd appreciate that. If you want to get in touch with us for any reason, mail@politicsguys.com as well. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook, and we always put those links in the show notes. The executive producers of Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andre Masker, Daniel Toe, Chris Wilkerson, and Nathan Sosnowski. We'll be back with a new show next week. We hope you'll join us.